Welcome to the last episode of the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. For the calendar year, that is. Don't worry, I'll never stop this podcast. In fact, I plan on delivering another 15 episodes in just this season alone. That being said, I'll be taking a break from editing and uploading new episodes for most of January. Daily history through pop culture posts will still be on Instagram, and essays and newsletters will still go up on Substack as usual. Speaking of online media outlets, in these, the remaining days and hours of each year, those sites like to put out their year-in-review lists, top 10 moments in music, this year in television, best movies of the year, and so forth and so on. This podcast eats those lists up because they act as outstanding summative primary sources. Someone had to curate all the events of the previous year based on their own gauge of importance, and doing so in retrospect. Pop culture events in April may seem unable to be matched in May, but by October they may be all but forgotten. December is the judge for the previous 11 months. And if your show or film or song can stay relevant through Christmas, then you will help define the year that was. The topic of the first segment today comes from 1988, and it was along these lines. Take a listen.
But even if it's not, even if you're the only one that does this with me, I have a feeling we're going to have a great conversation. So this is Nikki.
Yeah.
And you're not terribly far from me, right? You're from Boston.
I'm in Boston. Yes. Yes, I am. I work at GBH, which is Boston's local public media station in the education department.
And you say it so simply, like it's a local station. It's like the flagship of the entire...
It is a powerhouse station. Yeah.
And I have been using WGBH... stuff, everything from we were talking about American Experience. My favorite thing to use in medieval European history class is a class I teach called The Western Tradition with Dr. Eugen Weber. It's from 1989.
So much good stuff.
And you know, Metropolitan Museum of Art worked with that one. And it's just like, so WGBH isn't just, oh, it's just our local.
Say it like we're just a little local, right? Yeah. But we do a lot, especially a lot for educators in the classroom, which is.
And we thank you for that.
Yeah.
It really helps us.
Our pleasure.
You know, I think for a lot of, especially as a teacher starting out.
Yeah.
That's like the savior. Yeah. It's like, this is 55 minutes long. Perfect. Like,
yeah, great. Yeah.
I didn't have anything planned, but now I do, you know.
And it's I think, you know, using media as a way to make education fun, inclusive, accessible, and I just think, you know, engaging. Like, kids can really, I think, grasp the material in a different way when they see a video or listen to something.
It mixes things up, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you get plenty of positive feedback for that reason.
Yes.
And, you know, and then it's just like an endless amount of things that WGBH is responsible for. So, again, thank you.
You're welcome.
So
our pleasure.
At my table, you found something I just picked up recently, the Disney yearbook from 1988.
Yes.
And it doesn't have, as far as I know, like photographs of each of the people like an actual yearbook would with, you know, their
it does not.
Quotes. It's more of like a year in review kind of thing.
Exactly.
From a Disney perspective.
Yes.
And what caught your eye originally? Well, what caught your eye in general about this thing?
Well, I just think, I mean, I work a lot in the kids media space, so it was something that caught my attention. And I, you know, grew up with Disney and Disney characters, but I had never seen a Benjamin Franklin Mickey Mouse before, so that is what caught my eye.
I wonder how they chose who would
do what, right?
They're all kind of nutty characters,
yes.
So it's no matter which way you go about it. So Goofy appears to be George Washington.
That is my guess. Yes,
and is that meant to be? Well, maybe Alexander Hamilton is Donald Duck.
A very angry-looking Donald Duck.
Or maybe the other two are just anybody at all because you're, you know, he has a kite.
I knew it was Benjamin Franklin.
Has to be Franklin.
Kite. Yes.
Did they even include, I don't see it there, but they sometimes have, you know, the rising sun. Oh, actually, I think Donald Duck is George Washington
because he's
behind the desk. I was looking at it from a different perspective, so...
Yeah.
Regardless, they're celebrating the Constitution.
Yes.
And for those of you listening, I'm sure you are listening to this podcast because you have a background in history. So you know that the Constitutional Convention began in May of 1787, concluded in September of 1787, but the ratification by the several states didn't finish up until 1788. And so in the mid and late 80s, we had almost like a repeat, if you will, of the bicentennial. So I missed the bicentennial because I wasn't born yet. You missed this bicentennial because
well.
You were born the following year.
Right.
Now, in retrospect, I'm like, oh, that's why they had an extra special, when they had the 4th of July with the Statue of Liberty, they did a lot of work on the statue during 1986.
So interesting.
So
yeah.
That by 87 they could have this. And I'm like, that's why they had it, because the Statue of Liberty was given as a gift by France
right.
to commemorate the centennial of the Constitution.
Oh.
And so now we have, celebrations of the bicentennial of that.
Interesting.
And I guess the question that I'm asking you is, what ideas or behavior does this convey?
Yeah.
What does it say to you that Disney felt the need to do this?
Yeah, it's so interesting, right? Because, I mean, Disney has an incredibly wide reach, right? And I don't think of them as big in the education space. Mm-hmm. When it comes to me, I think of them big at time as entertainers, right? But this, to me, seems like an effort to kind of, celebrate America, American pride, via characters that kids know and love, right? And share kind of the story of our country via familiar Disney characters.
It matches up with Walt Disney's original view. He was, the Hall of Presidents says mm-hmm, it all, like mm-hmm. that. When they brought that to the World's Fair and then to the,
sure.
the parks themselves.
Oh, that's so right. Yeah, I forget. Like, they do a lot of...
Yeah, they have Liberty Square and Disney World.
Yeah,
and he never got to see that one play out. But
right.
I went to Disneyland this summer for the first time, and there was a version of that. There's, like, the old America part, and...
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in... And that matches up to when that park opened in 1950s.
Right.
Like, that, rebirth of America after World War II is we're a world leader now, so we get to celebrate our history and our heritage
sure.
and deliver it to the rest of the world. What really strikes me about this
yeah.
is this is just on the cusp before the Renaissance for Disney. So the following year is when The Little Mermaid
came out. What I grew up with, right? Yeah, that's the Disney I know, The Little Mermaid and then Aladdin and all those, yeah.
So I feel like this was kind of a down... That's why they're using the characters of Mickey and Goofy and Donald, because they've been around forever.
Forever.
And I can't really name any movies in the 80s that most people would really... Fox and the Hound.
It was Bambi?
That was like 60s.
No, that
50,
was way that was earlier. Yeah.
They didn't really have much... And so, this yearbook you're flipping through it,
they're
having all...
I'm looking at some
of the... They celebrate the 50th anniversary of Snow White.
Yep.
Which, I just mentioned two movies right there. One that was just redone, Little Mermaid, just this last year.
Yes.
And then Snow White is in the process of being...
live-action
remake. The live-action version
of
it, which seems to be hitting some stumbling blocks right now.
Right.
But it's... This seems to be kind of like that lull... Mm-hmm. For Disney, of like they weren't, I think managerial wise, they were in kind of a funky place
kind of
in the
place.
80s.
Yeah.
And the parks are doing fine, but as far as their reach, I don't think they were really getting
to.
It
wasn't like what they are today, right?
Yeah. So I'm curious if you think that does this almost seem like they're resigned to, like, well, this is what we do now?
Yeah, in a way. It's even funny, too, because in here they even call out Sesame Street, which is so funny because that's one of, PBS's shows.
You've heard of that one.
I've heard a little bit familiar with that one, and talk about TV for kids and making learning fun. And I think this is before Disney was even in television. I don't know exactly when they made the
Because they had the wonderful world of Disney starting way back, actually simultaneously with the opening of Disneyland in
right.
the 50s. They had that. And I remember watching plenty of, because they made a lot of movies, especially made for TV movies, the live action ones in the 50s that were all about, American history.
Mm-hmm.
They would, or some kind of basting.
Interesting. So all about American history.
To try to, you know.
It's so not my point of reference for Disney. That's so interesting. Yeah.
If not about American history, at least like set in historic periods. Like I remember watching one about the Civil War when I was a kid. And it was like this you know, Confederate kid that gets captured by Yankees. And, you know, it's but it was like for that purpose of, you know, creating a national unity, having a national culture, having something that everybody could rally behind. Like Disney was like almost himself was very adamant about that.
Yeah.
Of using his company to celebrate American culture and Americanism.
Yeah.
You know, and what it means to be an American. And when he died in the late 60s.
Sure.
So I've done a few different episodes about different Disney things.
Yeah.
And it seems like that post Walt Disney passing away, like we're without a leader. We don't know where to go. There's kind of, I want to say a power grab, but there's like a power vacuum.
Void, yeah.
And they don't, there's kind of like, so this one almost seems like, because like I said before we record, you can find these yearbooks, I think throughout the 80s. And so it looks like that's where they're dabbling with. They're like, okay, we're just going to
see what, yeah, what sticks, right?
And, you know, maybe this is all we're doing. So why do you think that The Little Mermaid turned things around? Why did that turn things around? I know you were born the same year it came out.
Yeah.
But when you've watched that movie growing up, what is it about that specific movie that you think transformed Disney?
Yeah, I think there's something about, I think music plays a big part of it, right? Like, there's something so magical about those films and having the songs that you can sing all the time and that fairy tale kind of experience that transports kids, right? I think it just so leans into kids' imaginations and feeds into that inherent kind of wonder and joy of make-believe that kids have. I remember seeing Beauty and the Beast in theaters like three times when I was little, you know?
That came right after.
Yeah, that was like right after. Yep.
It was another huge
one. Then Aladdin, and yeah, we would listen to the music all the times. And then I think Disney does an excellent job, too, of you know, branding itself. And then, like, we had the dress-ups, we had the toys. Mm-hmm. Like, it was everything, right? And all my friends knew it. And everybody had this collective kind of reference point for it as well, which I think like is what lends itself to that magic. Yeah, there's something just totally magical about it.
This is almost like an artifact of the last like before Disney became
that switch.
I remember when I was a kid, I never got to go to Disney World. All my friends did,
right?
And I was always so envious of them because it just looks like such a cool place.
Yeah,
but it became that much more of this wonderland.
You gotta go.
When the movies to boom, boom, boom.
Totally.
Throughout the 90s. And
it was like nonstop, right? They happened one after another, and they were hit after hit after hit.
And even the ones, so like The Hunchback of Notre Dame didn't do so well.
I still owned it on VHS.
Hercules didn't do so
great. Own that one too. But
it was like, I have a chart that I've used for my pop culture class for a quiz before, and it has the top five highest grossing movies as well as their critical score, like you know, what their Rotten Tomatoes score is.
Mm-hmm.
And for I think at least six of for the 1990s, for like six of the 10 years, there's at least one Disney animated movie at the top.
Wow.
And they tend to have Rotten Tomatoes scores of like 98, 99.
Incredible.
You know, Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Like you said, Aladdin.
Little Mermaid.
You know, Lion King.
A Lion King, yeah.
All of these, just whoa, whoa, whoa. And so it's no wonder, really, that they keep making them over again.
Yeah.
You know, because they get to say new things with it.
Right.
But it also is like they know that the generation that grew up with that have kids.
Such nostalgia for it too, right? And it still goes on to this day. Like I think of Frozen. I was a preschool teacher. Every morning we would have to sing Let It Go at some point.
And they had to let it go.
And the parents would be like, well, I'm ready to let that song go for sure. But
come up with a new song, Disney.
Yeah.
They really have changed. And it's like, so we can almost like mark it right there. It's like, this is the last point.
Yeah.
Disney was kind of like just one of many resources.
Right.
Because just the look of that book could easily fit in with a Golden Book or it could fit right next to like a Sesame Street book. You know, one of those
100%
illustrated ones. It doesn't stand out.
No.
It doesn't look like anything special.
No.
And it's like it just took those, that transformation that happened in starting the following year.
Yeah.
To Sort of like the Constitution itself, I suppose. Maybe not at all, but it just try to link it back to that.
Yeah.
We're at a social studies conference, so I can say it here. I think it is the Constitution that allows for all this to happen.
Yeah.
First Amendment. I mean,
for
that's
sure.
That freedom to be creative, to try new things.
Yeah.
To not have to worry about getting shut down.
Yeah. And like the freedom to evolve, right? And I think that's part of what Disney has done so well, right? That space to like kind of change and grow and adapt as we do as a country,
and,
right?
And they have plenty of treasury behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So that if something doesn't work out,
they have the room to fail.
Like,
right?
Yeah, we can, you know, it's not like something else where they absolutely need to make it. Like, everything rides on this thing. It's like, that movie didn't do so good. All right.
We'll make another one.
We'll just build a new ride at the park, and that'll make up for it.
Exactly.
Go get one of our celebrities out there and
exactly.
Go on a concert tour or something. But,
exactly. Yeah, it's such an interesting case study looking at Disney over the years, for sure.
Well, it's remarkable that we can get a 15-minute critical conversation out of this book
that
I pulled from a bin at Goodwill by the Pound, that it was about to leave this earth.
Yeah.
And I saved it from, I assume that's the next stop after that place.
No, it's really incredible. I've never seen anything like it, especially as someone who grew up with Disney books. In my house, I never would have even known this was a Disney book.
And I picked up a previous time, they had a VHS that was something very similar. It wasn't like a specific movie, but it was from the era of the big, clamshell white cases. When they opened up. It came from that era, but it just had like Mickey, just like regular Mickey on the cover.
Yeah.
And I forget the name of it, but I picked one of those up at a Goodwill by the Pound a couple weeks ago. And I was like, I feel like it was the same idea of just like a year in review kind of thing.
Yeah.
Maybe just a bunch of cartoons. Because again, that was a time where they didn't have a lot, they weren't really producing big time stuff. And so they were just kind of going back to their archives, going back to their collections.
It even reminds me of Fantasia.
Yeah.
Right?
Remember when they brought that back?
Yes. And I remember the original too. And it was more like a collection of different animations.
Yeah.
It wasn't like one overarching.
Because that was them trying something else.
Yeah.
Back when they made that.
Yeah. And, I remember that movie terrified me and I couldn't stop watching it at the same time.
I remember being not, because I watched it when it was some anniversary thing in the 90s when they came back out with it. And I was like, so what's the story here?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that it was like vignettes. Yeah. They weren't.
You're like, I don't get how.
Full narrative.
Like,
I'm like,
Pegasus is frolicking right. Have to do with Mickey in a hat, you know?
With brooms chasing him around and stuff. I'm like, what? And I'm like, oh, I get it. It is brilliant. Yes.
I also wonder, too, though, like in today's media landscape for kids, which is so loud, right? There's so many choices, so many big players. You know, like Disney really had the sweet spot, especially in the 90s, where there weren't endless choices too, right?
Yeah.
Especially for movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it let them, I think, dominate so clearly.
Yeah, because they had the apparatus in place well ahead of time.
Oh, yeah.
So, 1988 doesn't mean that they didn't have anything. It was just
they
weren't really using their resources well enough.
Totally.
And then, so by the 90s, when they really start clicking, everybody else is like, whoa.
Right,
their heads
are, they had so much time to experiment and try stuff. And I think that's a luxury that other, companies probably didn't have. They had to get it right on the first time,
And it matches also up with the Gen X way of doing, Gen Xers tend to get the reputation of being, slacker.
Yeah, sure.
But there's plenty of motivated,
of course,
imaginary, that whole, and so the 90s was their time to shine, and I wouldn't be surprised if, Pixar.
Pixar,
right? Like, that's
That's
the computer people and putting it all together. So, you were very lucky to grow up as a kid through the 90s.
I know.
I was born kind of on the cusp between
80s and 90s.
Gen X and
millennials.
I think I'm a Xennial or something
sure,
like that.
Sure,
sure. Xennial. And so it's like we were very fortunate, I think, to witness all these transformations because here by 2023, I feel like all movies just kind of get made the same. All animated stuff.
It was like the formula's down, and then it was,
And we got to see that very inventive time period.
Definitely.
And
definitely.
Thanks the minds like Mickey Mouse, who's also Ben Franklin.
Well, this is like so interesting for me, too, to get some more of this backstory behind Disney's like history, because I wouldn't even know that they dabbled with you know, the Constitution.
Well, and I think a lot of it also, there's like Peanuts, they did a lot of history stuff too. They have a whole thing about the Constitutional Convention.
Yes, I think I did know about that.
And they do one for the Mayflower, which is
right.
The first, like, it's the first time you get to see like adults
In Peanuts,
and they're really weird drawn.
Oh my god, I can only imagine.
they don't look good.
Like, yeah, I'm like, there's a reason they didn't bring them in.
It's a kid world. And yeah. The kids, I mean, if you watch a Peanuts cartoon, like The Great Pumpkin, like these are terrible parents. They let their kid sleep in a doghouse.
I mean,
at 3 a.m. I mean, and his sister has to go get him. Like, that's
not good.
DCYF
not
call.
Good.
You know?
Yeah, that is problematic. Yeah.
And you know,
so many things
though.
I'm like, we never would see that today.
And then there's people in the neighborhood giving a kid. They're actually storing rocks in their house.
Oh no.
Just so when this kid shows up,
stop.
They give him a rock.
Stop.
I watched that recently. I'm like, who does that? That's
this
awful.
This explains all of our anxiety issues. You know? Yeah.
It was like. So there's adults out there that actually collect rocks just to give this one kid.
Oh my gosh,
Charlie Brown.
Aww.
To make him feel worse.
I know, poor Charlie Brown. Yeah,
everybody's always picking on him.
Poor Charlie Brown. Yeah.
I appreciate you so much for coming.
Yeah,
by
thank you so much for having me.
And I think it's just this is a great start to hopefully.
You
come back at the end of this,
conference.
And
yeah.
I'm gonna have like 18 hours.
I can't wait, and I'm gonna listen. I can't wait to listen to hear more.
This one fantastic. Actually will be on pretty soon since this is a yearbook. And
oh yeah.
35 years old, so this
is time.
Show up before the end of the year.
Perfect. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Using the end of one year to reflect and the start of a new one to look ahead has been pretty standard practice well before the birth of mass media. Most historians point to the post-World War I era, the 1920s, as the birth of an American mass media and a true American popular culture. But there were inklings of such a thing developing as early as a century before that. The 1820s saw the country trying very hard, in fact, to create a national identity and culture to go along with it. Technological and economic developments were underway in this era of good feelings, supported by a much beloved and relied upon newspaper industry. National unity was the spirit of the day, and the second generation, post-revolution, was reaching anywhere and everywhere to pull out talismans that could be used to help this mission along. Enter Gilbert du Motier, the Marquis de Lafayette. The hero of both the American and French revolutions was invited to visit the United States by President James Monroe in 1824, and later that year he sailed to America to begin his grand tour that would take him to all 24 states and more receptions, dinners, and balls than any Marquis could ever imagine. I met with Leslie Rainey of the American Friends of Lafayette while we were both attending the NCSS conference in Nashville earlier this month. The organization she belongs to was founded in the 1930s to celebrate the contributions of the French noblemen to the cause of the American Revolution. And just as Americans were doing 200 years ago, the AFL is looking ahead to a big event starting next year.
Start at the National Council for the Social Studies Conference in Nashville, Tennessee. As far as the exhibitor space goes, I'm with Leslie Rainey from the American Friends of Lafayette. And I think if you've been keeping up with pop culture lately, especially with the depiction of the Marquis de Lafayette in the musical Hamilton, that is the one we're talking about, is the Marquis de Lafayette. I don't think he's ever left us as far as being a pop culture figure, would you say?
That's true. I mean, a lot of cities are named Fayetteville or Lafayette. Streets are named Lafayette, College Lafayette. And LaGrange is in Georgia. It looked like his farm back home, and they renamed it in honor of Lafayette.
And it's so he's almost like the original. I remember watching a documentary about him one time. It wasn't that long ago. And it was one of those kind of documentaries where they went to the modern places that they're talking about and showed you, it wasn't all reenactment or anything like that. And they made a point of saying that when he arrived in New York Harbor, they said it was the 1820s equivalent of when the Beatles arrived at JFK Airport, or it wasn't JFK then, but you know, in New York when they arrived to invade America, basically. Is that where you would, how would you portray it the same way too, that he was welcomed into the country as this great figure, this celebrity really?
Yeah, when he approached the harbor, there were over 100,000 people that turned out to greet him. He left France. It's very, really interesting, the history behind this, because the president, James Monroe, invited him in advance of America's 50th anniversary, which would have been in 1826, to come and remind the country of our roots and what we fought for 50 years ago. And the country at that time was very divided politically. Yeah. And in 1824, he accepted the invitation. He left France, kind of waved goodbye to a couple people at the dock, hopped on the ship, and when he arrived in New York, he received a hero's welcome. He was the last living major general of the American Revolutionary War. And he was so loved by the people because they recognized that without his help and the help of France, we probably would not have won the war. We didn't have the money, didn't have the arms, the supplies, even the clothing for the military people. We didn't have factories building guns and bombs. And he really supported the American cause. And that's all because of a mentor he had back in France who asked him to join the Freemasons. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about the freedom of all mankind, and they were anti-slavery. Mm-hmm. So he brought a lot of issues that we kind of talk about today to our country back in the 1700s and in 1824.
The Freemasons get a very funny reputation throughout history, and even present day. They're always referred to as like a secret society, and I guess the best way to portray it would be a society with secrets. And now that's actually putting things together. And Washington, of course, was a Freemason as well, so they had that connection. And I know the two of them forged almost like a father and son relationship as they fought together. But it also makes a lot more sense as to why... when I was mentioning before we hit record that I used to work at a museum that has a tavern that Lafayette, they have the sign saying that he visited there, because on the top floor of that tavern was and still is a Grand Lodge of the Freemasons. Ooh. And it was, you know, the owner of the landlord of the tavern was himself a Mason, and they met there. And so the tour that you're describing, 1824 to 26, that celebratory tour, is very similar to the 1789 Washington tour of the states after he's elected president. And I feel like, I wonder if when they were putting that tour together in 1824, the idea of it was to do something similar. Because my understanding of the Washington tour, and he basically take the exact same route, you know, that in Washington stayed at that same tavern that I'm referring to in during his tour and visit to New Hampshire. It was his idea was to continue to push the idea of American national identity and unity. He was one of the original celebrities as well. He was probably the most recognizable figure. And he recognized that, and he brought with him his blue general uniform from the war. And when he would approach a town, when there was a population center coming up, he would stop his procession, change into his uniform, get onto his horse, also from the war, and parade into town. And so here's President Washington. Let's rally behind him. He's probably the only recognizable figure, maybe the only one other than Lafayette. So did Lafayette do something similar? Did he adopt, did he wear any of his, because in 1824 they didn't have photography, they didn't have any, like, so how would they be able to spot that guy as him other than...
Well, it's interesting. You know, when you travel, you kind of wear more comfortable clothes. And when you're going to a formal engagement, you'll dress in your full military outfit. But a funny story about our area, because I'm reenacting June 9th and 10th in 2025 of the Bicentennial of the Farewell Tour, which it actually starts this summer in August and goes through September of 2025. And when he came through our area, he was dressed in full, you know, military outfit. He was greeting people he hadn't seen in years, crying, so happy to see his old friends, the Oneida Indians. And when he hopped on the canal boat to go to Little Falls, New York, he was in a hurry to get to Boston to lay the cornerstone at Bunker Hill. there, and he was in a hurry. And, of course, the trip was taking more time than expected because everybody wanted to see him. It was only supposed to be a three-month tour and ended up being 13 months, 24 states, and 6,000 miles. So it was a big deal. So when he gets on the boat, the canal boat, in Utica to head to Little Falls, he got in his pajamas right away. Yeah. And when he got to Little Falls, about 30 miles down the road, they had torches on each side of the canal, and the whole city came out to greet him. So, of course, he had to stop, get dressed, and get out and change and greet everyone. Yeah, very exhausting.
It probably felt really good, though.
Yeah.
He wasn't an egotistical person, obviously. I mean, just doing what he did when he was 19 years old speaks more to him as being a selfless person, that he's willing to sacrifice all of his wealth and comfort to go off, and his status in France to go off and potentially lose his life over somebody else's his cause. So that seems to have stayed with him, that he remained rather humble throughout all
this.
He did
remain humble, and it's just I think it speaks to the character of the man, because he was very involved in caring about freedom. At a young age, even at 13, an article he wrote that his favorite kind of a horse would be the horse that bucked the rider off, because it was independent and had a mind of its own. That he valued that at a young age. And at 7, he got married at 16 to Adrienne. She was 14 at the time. So his father-in-law had a dragoon, and he led some of the troops there. And he was doing that at 17. At 18, he wanted to come to America. King Louis XVI said, no way. He signed up anyway. He got a commission, but the Continental Congress had no money to pay him. He said, that's okay, I'll pay my own way. He bought a boat when he was 18, came to America, and was leading troops under George Washington at 19. Wow. So I think, we sometimes sell our teenagers short, that they're really adults who just need more experience. And I just think he's somebody everyone can look up to, including our teens, our next generation.
And now, as we're talking about his return tour, his visit 50 years later, he's middle-aged, he's a senior citizen, and still portraying qualities that we should be celebrating and helping, people getting. Mm-hmm. You were mentioning about the canal, and I was just talking earlier to a pair of fellow podcasters, history teachers, about the Erie Canal as well. And in 1824, that thing has just barely have been completed. It's brand new. And so I got to think that the mapping of his route around the country, it was an opportunity for the United States to kind of demonstrate and show off, this is what we've done since you were last here. Look at what we've been able to accomplish. And if there's anybody they're trying to impress, he would be somebody that they wanted. You had a role in this, right? Mm-hmm. The symbology around the Erie Canal, they began, constructing it on July 4th in, I think, 1819, as a symbolic thing of, we are going to be economically independent from the rest of the world on Independence Day, starting here. And the symbology of him showing up for the 50th, that kind of round number, it seems like a 20th century kind of thing, where we like to celebrate things in increments of 10, the 10th anniversary of the 20th. So it's funny to me that so early in the country's history, that 50th mark was important enough. They're like, all right, let's get the all-stars together. Let's get all the celebrities from that conflict that are still alive anyway, and put them all together here. Do you think any of that is telling of the time period, of the culture of the country at the time?
I absolutely do, because that's when, organizations like the Sons of the American Revolution, the Daughters of the American Revolution were founded, mm-hmm. because you're a generation out from, our country becoming independent from a monarchical rule. Yeah. And really, they considered what was happening in America to be like a big, giant experiment. Right. Because when you think of the preamble to the Constitution, we the people, there's no other document in human history that really allow people freedom to kind of design their own future. And so, yes, I think the 50th year is significant. And, you know, as we're talking about it, when he does his, we're doing the bicentennial reenactment day by day on the exact day and the exact place of where he did his 13-month tour 200 years ago. We're going to do that day by day. This is the largest reenactment in history, and we're going to try to contact the Guinness Book of World Record and hope they come out and support what we're doing.
And each of those stops is an opportunity to remind people of what you were just talking about.
Exactly, to educate people.
It's lost on people all the time. I hear it frequently. They're always talking about America is a democracy, and it's not. It's a republic. It's a constitutional republic. And that was something that was brand new, or at least hadn't been around since antiquity, when the, you know, something as large. I know the Dutch had a republic as well, but it was like something as big as the United States and growing by 1824. Louisiana Purchase was 20 years old by that point. So it's a growing republic. It's something to really celebrate then. And 200 years later, that it's still intact,
right.
And it's you know it's still right. representing we the people, and it's limiting the government and all the values that Lafayette had from a young age on.
Well, what I was going to add, because I agree with you 100%, was this precedes America's 250th birthday, which is in 2026.
That's true.
So I feel very like this is a unique time in history. We are lucky to be living history, reenacting it, making it alive again for the younger generation, because we should be proud of our history. This is a wonderful thing, America, and all the freedom we try to bring people. Again, we're not perfect. Who is, right? But it's evolving, and every day we're trying to be more inclusive, trying to give women more rights, minorities more rights, and Lafayette was all for that way back then. So that's why he's a man of today,
a
global
sure,
visionary,
yeah.
yes.
And alongside all of his the people that he looked up to and the ones that he joined here in America, we were talking before at your table about the French Revolution, his part, his role in that. And the two are always tied together because, you know, in a, at least a very basic way, inspired one inspired the other. And in the case of Lafayette, the people who spurred it along were sometimes the same people as well. But the big difference, of course, is that we're an ocean away from the country we broke away from, whereas they were among the group. And so it has that strange dynamic. And that's why it was that much more violent and not something that stuck, right? Ours... Because you know, they were having revolutions all the time for the next, like, 50 years after that, if not later. In the United States, we stuck with ours, and our revolution was proven to be successful by 1801 at the very earliest, and definitely by 1824 when he comes back. It's like, we had our revolution, we made our country, we have our form of government, we have a society that's growing. It's and that what you're doing next year... And for the next couple of years is so perfect because it keeps the country young, it keeps it vibrant, it keeps it moving, instead of getting tired and old and saying, oh yeah, we're just like those countries in Europe, we're 200, you know, 1,000 years old, and it keeps things going in that forward visionary way like Lafayette wanted. So I'm glad that we stopped and talked about this stuff, and I feel foolish trying to talk about something other than this when what you're doing and what he did 200 years ago, what you're doing next year and what he did 200 years ago are excellent documents of their own time. And I'm so glad that... where can people find more information about your project?
And go to Lafayette200.org and actually follow the Frenchman day by day as he goes on his 13-month farewell tour.
You actually have one person that's depicting Lafayette.
We have two actors that will be depicting him.
Okay.
And they're very good actors. In fact, if you go to the website on the main page, there's a 2-minute teaser with one of the actors on it. It's really great. He's riding in a convertible. Oh, I love this new carriage, you know. And it's really cool. I'm really looking forward to reenacting it. It's going to be fun.
As humble as a guy he probably was, I think if he had access to a convertible, he would definitely ride it.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe not a flashy one, but just... You know, maybe like a Mustang or something.
He kind of made the best of every situation. He had this indefatigable and unflappable positive outlook on everything. And he was just, I think he inspired our General George Washington at the time when he really needed support and trust. And he grew to love this young man as like a son. And I think it was mutual the other way, because Lafayette lost his father during the Seven-Year War in, you know, in his country. He lost his father at the age of two fighting. Aww. And so he grew to love George Washington as a father. So that's really what made me fall in love with the Marquis.
Like, I don't know if Washington ever mentioned him. Like, yeah, you know, the 7 Years War, I basically started that.
But, yeah.
Awkward. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
I hope we get to work some more in the future.
I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast. There will be a break in episodes for a few weeks, but by all means, follow me on social media for interesting posts about history through pop culture. The quickest way to get to these online hangouts is everything-history.com. Until next time, this is the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.